Lord, we do thank you that you've given us your word to help us understand how you would have us live. Lord, help us to understand the important things you want us to learn about contraceptives this afternoon, and please give us hearts that are willing to change. Amen. Well, before we get started, I'll just put you out of your misery in case you're wondering where my accent is from. I'm from Sydney, Australia, and there you can see the beautiful Sydney Harbour Bridge. My church is actually just here. I see the harbour every Sunday, which is just lovely. And this is my wonderful family when we were on holiday last year. The reason I was asked to come and speak to you today is because I've written this book. My first book was called Fearfully and Wonderfully Made, which is, of course, taken from Psalm 139, just taken that passage where it's described in such a beautiful way how God forms us in the womb. This is a book that covers all aspects of ethics at the beginning of life, and the particular issue we're looking at today is contraception. So let's just remind ourselves of the miracle of creation that's described in Psalm 139. Human conception begins with fertilisation of an egg by a sperm, and this creates a single cell called a zygote. The usual word for the female human gamete is oocyte. Egg is a more culinary term, but I shall use it today because it's more familiar. From this point, the development of the person is a continuum through pregnancy and childhood to adulthood, and all the DNA required for full maturity of the human being is present in this single cell. So in embryology terms, we have here a member of the species Homo sapiens. This is a highly magnified view of a sperm burrowing through the wall of an egg. And cell organisation begins immediately with the first cell division occurring within 24 hours of conception, and cellular division continues while the embryo travels down the fallopian tube towards the uterus. At day 5 or 6, we have a hollow ball called a blastocyst, which then arrives at the uterus at the end of the first week, and it begins to implant. This is where the embryo attaches to the uterine wall, and the mother's blood supply starts to nourish it. Sadly, this doesn't always happen successfully, in which case you would have a very early miscarriage. At week 3, the future spinal cord begins to develop and the heart tubes begin to fuse and blood cell production in the embryo begins. Week 4, the embryo measures 3 millimetres in length and begins to curve into a C shape, and its own heart starts to beat in a regular rhythm. We have development of the brain, thyroid, eyes and ears beginning. You once looked like this. I think it's part of the PR problem of the embryo. Week 5, we have continued development of the eyes, mouth, nose, sinuses, lungs, arms, hands and legs begin to grow, and the embryo's own blood supply starts to circulate. Week 6, the embryo measures about a third of an inch in length. We have beginning of formation of the feet, ears, nipples and bones, continued development of the face and the brain, and arm and legs will lengthen with foot and hand areas distinguishable. Week 7, the embryo measures half an inch in length. The trunk lengthens and straightens, and the upper limbs are longer and bent at the elbow. Kidneys start to develop, and elbows and toes are visible, and the limbs will move spontaneously if you look on ultrasound. Week 8, the embryo measures just over an inch in length. Facial features continue to develop, with eyelids and ears taking shape. The head is more rounded. The beginnings of all essential external and internal structures are present, and you can see that even while still at the embryo stage, an enormous amount of development has taken place. Isn't God clever? Now, at 8 weeks, the terminology changes and we start to call it a fetus. At 3 months, the fetus is about 3 inches in length. The face and body are now formed and all organs are beginning to function. And basically, the remainder of pregnancy is just a matter of maturation of the fetus. At 4 months, tooth enamel is developing and the pregnant woman can detect fetal movement, and the fetus is producing its own hormones. At 5 months, the fetus can develop hiccups if it swallows too much amniotic fluid, and the two sides of the brain are starting to differentiate. At 6 months, hair begins to grow. Gas exchange is possible in the lungs, and the sense of smell is functioning. The eyes begin to detect light and can produce tears. Then things start to get a bit squashy in there, and hopefully at term, a healthy baby is born. Now, I don't think many people would disagree that a human newborn is a human being who deserves protection. And of course, it's the same human being from the beginning of its development. And I have gone too far. There we go. As everything it needed to grow was present from the very beginning, from that very first cell, and it directed its own development since then, I would suggest that it's arbitrary to say that human life begins at any time after fertilisation. So biologically, when the sperm and egg joined, human life began. And as we will discover today, this relatively straightforward fact has been confused by modern medical terminology. I wrote the book Fearfully and Wonderfully Made because new technologies have created ethical dilemmas that we've never had to face before. And one of these is contraception. These days, contraception is easy to access, it works well, but what is their place in Christian marriage? There is so much misleading information in the media, it can be very hard to work out what is the right thing to do. But I hope to clarify things for you today by looking at the Bible. By looking at the Bible to see what guidance is there about family planning, to help you understand the terminology used in contraceptive marketing in order to understand what it means. And last of all, I'd like us to work out a Christian approach to the ethics of contraception. But before I start, just two warnings. What we're doing today is not a medical consultation. For Christians, choosing a contraceptive should involve a consideration of ethics, but that's not the only consideration. You need to talk to your own doctor to find out what is appropriate for you. I am a medical doctor, but I'm giving you ethical guidelines today. And secondly, any information you're given today is not intended to make you feel guilty about things you've done in the past. We all make mistakes, but we make our decisions based on what information we have at the time. What I hope to do today is to give you information to make better choices in the future. But our first question is it morally acceptable for Christians to use contraceptives at all? Now, I'm not going to go into a lot of historical detail, but you might be surprised to know that contraception was opposed by all Protestants from the time of Martin Luther until 1930. And it's still opposed by some denominations, especially Roman Catholics. Now, this isn't because no contraceptives were available. In fact, we've got records of contraceptives as early as ancient Egyptian times. They were, I guess, fairly messy in those days. The first spermicide we know of was crocodile dung, which was mixed with honey and placed in the vagina to avoid pregnancy. The history of contraception in the church is quite complex. I cover it in the book. But what's really important for us now is what is the right thing for Christians to do today? And the way we find that out is by looking at God's Word, the Bible. In particular, we need to look at the Bible's teaching on the purpose of marriage and the place of sex within marriage. And to understand this, we need to go back to the Garden of Eden and the creation of humans, because when we look at how God created us, we can understand more about how we ought to live. Now, in Genesis 1, we find that God made man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Genesis 1, verses 26 and 27. We're made to be relational creatures, living in relationship with God and other human beings. Then in verse 28, God blessed Adam and Eve and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground." We also know from chapter 2 that God also commanded the man not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. We can see that we're dependent creatures who were designed to live within the limits set for us by our loving Creator God. This is central to the Christian understanding of freedom. Even though when we have children, we are co-creators with God. We are unlike God in that we're not omniscient. We are to continue to observe the limits He has put in place. And while still in the Garden of Eden, God set forth the pattern for marriage after creating Eve to be a companion for Adam. In chapter 2, verse 24, we're told, "A man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." The new one flesh state is expressed in sexual intercourse between the husband and wife. The Hebrew word for the act of intercourse means to know. So the Bible does not consider this just a physical act in humans. It's also a giving of oneself, which produces personal, intimate connections in the relationship. And there's no doubt that becoming one flesh is a very important part of marriage. We see in both the Old and New Testaments that sexual intercourse is seen as a marital duty. Christians recognise two primary purposes of sex in marriage. It is unitive and procreative. Let me explain. Unitive refers to the expressing and strengthening of love and companionship between husband and wife and the mutual enjoyment the sex provides. Now, this is reflected in Genesis 2:24 down here. The unitive aspect of sex is described in biblical passages that talk about the delight that a husband and wife can have together and find in each other through sexual love. By passages that talk about this without any mention of children, we have a whole book of the Bible, Song of Songs, which talks about the delight of sexual love without the talk of having children. But sex in marriage is also procreative in purpose, for having children and perpetuating the human race, which we can see in Genesis 1:28. It's fairly obvious that the arrival of children is expected within marriage as a result of sexual intercourse, because as the husband and wife come together, so does the egg and sperm, resulting in a child for whom both of them are responsible. So children there are intended to be part of the blessing of marriage and are themselves a rich blessing from God. As the psalmist writes in Psalm 127, "Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior are the children of one's youth. Blessed is the man who fills his quiver with them." After the fall, man was still made in the image of God, we know from Genesis 9:6. But when sin entered the world, man became mortal, and the task of filling the earth became more challenging. However, God's purposes always prevail, and we're told in Genesis 3 that Adam named the woman Eve, meaning mother of all the living. But although the task of raising up future generations to be stewards of the earth is an important one, is it more important than the relationship between husband and wife? This is the question that's led to the division within the church regarding the role of contraceptives. So remember, we have two roles in marriage, unitive and procreative. In 1968, Pope Paul VI issued a papal encyclical called Humanae Vitae, which decreed that each and every marital act of sexual intercourse must of necessity retain its relationship to procreation. He pronounced that both the unitive meaning and the procreative meaning within marriage are to be realised in each and every sexual act. That means that a couple should always be open to the potential of begetting a child whenever they have sex. Now, his motive was good. He was acknowledging that all life depends on God, but it leads to the idea that marital sex with only a unitive intention is wrong. This led to the Roman Catholic teaching that the use of contraceptives has no place in marriage. But in contrast, the Protestant Church teaches that the unitive and procreative aspects of marital sex should apply to the overall marriage relationship, but not necessarily to each individual act of intercourse. And this does leave room for contraceptive use. At the same time, God obviously appears to tell us in the Bible that we should consider children to be the norm in marriage, even if it is not always possible. But it doesn't mean that every time you have sex, you have to make sure there is that potential of having a child. And this makes sense because while the world lasts, someone has to provide the human generations needed to rule and care for it. But at the same time, does that mean every couple has to have the maximum number of children? Well, even in the Old Testament, we can see that propagating the maximum number of children was not God's intention. For one thing, women are created, so we're not fertile all the time. Once a month we have a period where we're not fertile, and we're permanently infertile after menopause. Some couples are created sterile. In the New Testament, celibacy is offered to us as a legitimate lifestyle choice, so God clearly doesn't expect all human beings to produce as many children as possible. But wait a minute, I hear you say, what about Onan? The story of Onan is in Genesis 38. He was supposed to provide an heir for his deceased brother by having intercourse with his brother's widow, Tamar. When he did have sex with Tamar, he used the withdrawal technique to drop his sperm on the ground so she wasn't impregnated. And this is the one example of contraceptive use that we have in the whole Bible. God put Onan to death. And I've heard it said that this example indicates that Christians should never use contraceptives. But this is unlikely. We know that contraceptives were in use and quite commonly available in biblical times. And if they were forbidden, you would have expected it to be mentioned in the Bible. For example, in Leviticus 20, there's a whole list of sexual crimes, but no mention of a prohibition of contraceptive practices. If contraception use deserved the death penalty, how much more would we have expected it to be mentioned? It's much more likely that Onan's punishment was due to his failure to honour his dead brother and his disobedience to God's command. So the Bible then doesn't expressly forbid contraceptive use, but is contraceptive use endorsed? Well, in biblical ethics, motives are as important to God as our actions. He's interested in our hearts as well as our behaviour. We see this when we look at passages such as the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5. In view of the Bible's high regard for children, any attempt to avoid their birth, it must be done with a clear conscience and not for arbitrary or selfish motives. It's a serious decision to avoid having children if you're married. But contraception may have a place in marriage when it's used to time the arrival of children, such as to give couples time to strengthen their relationship before they start having babies. And if you've had one, you know how tiring and stressful it is when babies first arrive. Furthermore, in 1 Timothy chapter 5, we're told we need to provide for our family. Timing of children might be important to make sure you have the resources to provide for the children that you have. For example, a friend of mine when they had their third child, found that he was a baby with special needs. And the demand on them emotionally and physically in caring for their third child has made them realise that at this stage they would really struggle to care for a fourth. And so contraceptive use is certainly an ethical choice in that situation. Occasionally, a couple may be in a situation where contraceptive needs to be permanent. Not long ago, I was asked about a couple where they knew they had a serious genetic problem that they would definitely pass on to any children that they had. And in their situation, they decided that they would not be able to find the resources to care for that child, and they would have permanent contraception and look at adoption. But this will be the exception, not the rule. A full understanding of marriage will include being open to the arrival of children at some point, according to God's will. And it will be according to His will. Use of contraception needs to be a joint decision between husband and wife, and it needs to be made prayerfully. But you also need to be aware that God might overrule your plans. No contraceptive is 100% effective. We need to realise when we become sexually active that parenthood is always a possible outcome. If you're not prepared to fulfil your duties as a parent, you shouldn't have sex. But let's look at contraceptives more closely. And in order to understand contraceptives, we first need to understand how children are conceived. Now, I can see we have some mothers here, and please just bear with me as we cover this quickly, because I'm sure you probably know by now, but if you don't know, you really need to find out in a hurry, don't you? Women of childbearing age usually produce an egg every month, which is released from the ovary and travels down the fallopian tube during ovulation. During sexual intercourse, sperm is released from the man's penis and travels from the vagina up through the cervix to the uterus, and then it will travel into one or the other fallopian tubes. If there is an egg in that fallopian tube, fertilisation can take place. So we can see from this cross-section of the female reproductive system, the egg being released and travelling down into the uterus where it can implant after about a week. The embryo will grow all this time. Remember, I showed you a picture of a blastocyst, and that's the stage it's at when implantation takes place. And we've already mentioned that joining of the egg and the sperm to make an embryo is the first step of conception. But now we need to clarify some terminology. The definition of contraception in the Oxford Dictionary, which is what we use in Australia, is a method or drug to prevent pregnancy. Therefore, you might think a contraceptive, which means against conception, would just be working to keep the egg and the sperm apart. But these days, it's not so. Let me explain. Around the time the oral contraceptive pill was introduced, they weren't sure exactly how it worked. And it was possible that it might not only prevent the sperm from fertilising the egg, but it might also terminate the embryo's life by preventing implantation of the womb, which occurs about a week later. So we have fertilisation, the embryo travels down the fallopian tube, where if it bumps, the egg is released in fertilisation, it travels down the fallopian tube. If it bumps into a sperm, it can become an embryo, which by the end of the week will reach the uterus in time for implantation. Since such interference, if something interfered with the implantation of the embryo, it was realised that some people would say this constitutes an early abortion. So the solution that was developed for this problem was to equate conception with the time of implantation instead of fertilisation. That is, it got around the fact that the drugs acted after fertilisation, and the fact that it might cause a termination of the pregnancy by changing the time of when a pregnancy started, by definition. Because if there wasn't a pregnancy, you couldn't say you had an abortion. Now, whether this abortive mechanism actually works for the pill isn't clear, which I'll explain in a moment. But as a result of this change, as a result of this thinking, a change was made in the official terminology of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists in 1972, followed by an international group in 1985. So the accepted scientific view before this, that fertilization was the mark of conception and the beginning of a pregnancy, was altered to define conception and the beginning of pregnancy as starting at implantation. As a result, the link between fertilization and conception was broken. Pregnancy was still defined as the state of a female after conception and until termination of the gestation. But the text now dated a pregnancy, and by implication a human life, from the time of implantation of the embryo into the wall of the mother's uterus. And under the new definition, any device that prevented the embryo from implanting in the uterus could be marketed as a contraceptive. And the only drugs that could be called abortifacient or causing an abortion were ones that worked after implantation and not before. Because if you had no pregnancy, you couldn't have an abortion. This meant that there was an extra week between fertilisation and implantation where drugs could be marketed as contraceptives. Now, note that the people who made this definitional change didn't have the authority to do so. They weren't embryologists. And despite medical textbooks adopting the new definition, respected embryology textbooks still use the old system, marking conception and the beginning of human life as starting at fertilisation. Now, that's a complicated concept, but have I explained it? Okay, thank you. So that means there are two classes of contraceptives. Those that work before fertilisation, the classic definition, and prevent the sperm from joining with the egg. And then we have those that cause an early abortion by acting after fertilisation, or the other name, as I said, for those drugs are called abortifacients. These definitional changes explain a lot of the confusion that we're getting from the media. For example, you might hear some doctors publicly saying that certain drugs aren't abortifacient, but they're using their definition of pregnancy, which starts at implantation. But if you believe that pregnancy starts at fertilisation, that statement would not be true for you. No wonder we're all confused. But we can work out which category any contraceptive method falls into by considering how it works. Now, that's not as easy as you might think, but we do have some guidelines that can be used if you don't want to cause an early abortion. Now, remember the traditional definition of conception was the joining of the egg and the sperm during fertilisation, which forms an embryo. We were all once embryos, but we were never an individual egg or sperm. That means that egg and sperm are not morally significant, and it doesn't matter what happens to them in ethical terms. The ethical permissible risk contraceptives for Christians will be those that work to stop the egg and sperm from being in contact with each other. This group will include barrier contraceptives such as condoms or diaphragms, where a physical obstruction is placed between the sperm and the egg. You could achieve the same effect by limiting the availability of one or the other, either the egg or the sperm. Preventing the production of eggs would make fertilisation impossible, and this is usually done with hormones, and I've listed some there. Reliable suppression of ovulation is obtained with Implanon and hormone injections such as DMPA and NetN. Some of the trade names for those drugs are Depo-Provera, Depo-Megestron, Petagen, Norasteret and Syngestal. We can talk more about trade names later if you like. Similarly, the withdrawal method and natural family planning or fertility awareness methods will work by keeping the sperm out of the way. Natural family planning works by avoiding intercourse during the woman's fertile period so that no sperm is around if an egg is present. The withdrawal method aims to keep sperm out, period. Now, the methods that won't be okay are the ones that we know harm the embryo once it's formed. Now, this can occur at several places. You can damage the embryo after it's formed while it's travelling down the fallopian tube towards the uterus, or you can actually stop it from implanting once it's at the uterus site. Firstly, IUDs. If you can believe it, we still don't know exactly how IUDs work, but they appear to create an inflammatory response in the female reproductive tract, which is quite toxic to the embryo. This is a result of the body recognising the IUD as being foreign and mounting an immune response against it to try and destroy it. And this creates an environment in which an embryo just can't survive. It reduces its chance of survival as far as we know. So that's definitely going to be out of the question. Some hormonal implants containing the hormone levonorgestrel, these such as Jardel, Zarin and Femplant, usually work by trying to block ovulation so there's no egg. But this, it's not really reliable in these drugs. They also cause changes to the endometrium so that if an egg is released and an embryo is formed, there is a chance it will have trouble implanting in the uterus. So those drugs would not be ethically acceptable if you wanted to protect embryos from the time of fertilisation. Ormeloxifene is thought to have a similar effect. So these methods would also be a problem. But that leaves us with quite a few methods left out, and this is the tricky part, working out where they go. Basically, we have a group of contraceptives where we're not sure how they work, so we can't say exactly where they act. This group includes most of the hormonal contraceptives. Now, I'll explain the problem here using the combined oral contraceptive as an example because it's the most commonly used and the most controversial in Christian circles. It's easier to understand how they work if you're aware of the normal 28-day cycle of the female. The changes that occur in the ovary and uterus during each cycle are aimed at producing an egg for possible fertilisation by the sperm and preparing the endometrium, or the uterine lining, the womb lining, for implantation of an embryo so a baby can develop. So during the first half of her cycle, the egg develops in a follicle in the ovary, and that's in response to hormones that are released in the woman's body. The follicle increases in size until at the time of ovulation it releases the egg into the fallopian tube in response to a hormone surge. And that also acts to start thickening up the endometrium to prepare it for the implantation of the embryo. If fertilization doesn't occur, the hormone secretion stops, leading to a shedding of the endometrium, and the woman has her menstrual period, and the whole cycle starts again. Now, while there are many different formulations of the pill, they all work in much the same way, and there are three important methods of action. The main one is that it prevents ovulation or releasing of the egg by suppressing the release of the hormones that trigger ovulation. So that means there'll be no egg being released from the ovary into the fallopian tube. The second method of action is by inhibiting movement of the sperm through the cervix into the uterus by thickening the mucus that is found on the cervix. It makes it very thick and sticky, and it's just very hard for the sperm to move. And the third effect is that it makes the lining of the uterus thinner and hostile to the embryo, making it very difficult for the embryo to implant and survive. And here lies the crux of the debate. It's been argued that if the pill fails to prevent ovulation and an egg's released, and if the pill fails to thicken the mucus on the cervix and a sperm gets through, and if the sperm successfully travels up the fallopian tube and fertilizes the egg so that an embryo is formed, and if the third action of the pill is working and thins the lining of the uterus, then that embryo couldn't implant, and so you would have an early abortion because the embryo would then pass out with the menstrual flow. This is the argument used to say that the oral contraceptive pill is abortifacient, is a drug that causes an early abortion. However, there's an opposing argument which goes like this. If the pill fails to prevent ovulation and an egg is released, and if the pill fails to thicken the cervical mucus and the sperm gets through and travels up the fallopian tube and successfully fertilizes the egg so that an embryo is formed, and if ovulation has occurred, then the peak in the hormones, remember, that triggers ovulation must also have occurred, which means that the thickening of the endometrium must occur as well. And so you wouldn't end up with an early abortion, but an unplanned pregnancy. So the idea is that if the pill failed to stop ovulation, and if it failed to thicken the sperm, you'd also expect it to fail to thin the endometrium. Either it's going to work or it's not going to work. And that is the thinking behind those doctors who say that the oral contraceptive pill is not an abortifacient. Now, there are pro-life, committed Christian doctors on both sides of this debate. We just don't have the research evidence at this stage that answers the question of what the endometrium looks like when somebody taking the pill ovulates and creates an embryo. We don't know. No one's done the research. We don't know for sure what happens. It's unlikely the research will ever be done. The only people who could afford it are the drug companies. And from what I see on the internet, they're quite happy that we're not quite sure what happens. So this is a very difficult situation for committed Christians who want to make sure that they respect human life from the time of fertilization. So this is what we're left with. There's no evidence that the medications in the central list are abortifacient, but there's also no evidence that they're not. If this debate particularly troubles you, I can direct you to more information. But until we have more information, we are at a stalemate for those who want definite proof that the pill can never be used as an abortifacient. Now, I have looked at all the research papers involved in this debate, and personally, I am not convinced it's a problem. But we each need to decide for ourselves, because this is an important issue that needs to be consistent with our own conscience. Now, we can discuss this particular question later in question time. I'm going to leave time for questions at the end. But I'd just like to touch on emergency contraceptives before we go on to questions. What a lot of press coverage these methods have had with the court cases in the news. If you think back to the biblical purpose of sex in marriage, it's hard to see that a Christian couple would need to ever use emergency contraception. If you have sex with the person you're married to and are open to God blessing you with children, it's unlikely that it will come up. When I worked as a junior doctor, the usual scenario was a girl coming in after a one-night stand where the condom broke and just wanting some backup contraception. And actually, in our society, I think that's generally seen as a very responsible thing to do. However, it's possible that a Christian couple might be using contraceptives for a godly reason and have a contraceptive accident, so I'll just cover them quickly. Emergency contraception works on the idea that if you have sex without contraception, whether it's intended or not, you still have time to avoid pregnancy so long as you act within 72 hours by taking a pill or having a copper IUD inserted. For Christians, we'll use the same ethical categories as we did before. But once again, we've got a problem that we don't actually know how all of them work. We do know that all emergency contraceptives, including the copper IUD and morning after pills, probably impair implantation. So if an embryo has been formed after having sex and before you take emergency contraception, they will work as abortifacients, in which situation they will be unethical for Christians. However, the other way that most of them work, and I include Plan B, Ella and Previn in this, is by delaying ovulation. So if you knew where you were in your cycle, and most women don't, you could use them to delay ovulation if ovulation was still at least a few days away. It would be ethical because an embryo hasn't formed yet, and what you're doing is just delaying the release of the egg until there's been enough time for the sperm to die and not have the situation where there's the potential to form an embryo. I've got the details in the book. You can find out where you are in your cycle by going to see a doctor and getting the levels of hormones in your blood measured. So if you knew it was still a few days away before you ovulate, it would be ethical to use these drugs as a Christian. But you shouldn't take emergency contraception on the off chance that you might delay ovulation if it hasn't occurred yet. As I said, what's in our hearts is as important to God as our behaviour, and He knows our motives. If you want to consider use of emergency contraception as a Christian, you really need to go through the steps of finding out where you are in your cycle and making sure that you are not going to cause an early abortion by taking the morning after pill. This is a big topic, and there's a lot of information to take in. In the end, it's a decision for you and your husband to make together without either of you violating your conscience, which Romans 4:23 tells us is wrong. If we try to remember the privilege of child raising that God's given to us, working out contraception in marriage should not be a burden. So why does it cause us so much angst? The Western world is far more affluent than any society before us, and sadly, our affluence at times seems to make us more selfish rather than less. We can now see in our society the growing acceptance of a lifestyle that excludes children entirely and allows adults to live in a completely self-centered way. In such communities, children may not be seen so much as a gift, as a threat. In such communities, Christian writer Catherine Blanchard has said, life is fast-paced in the city and children make us less efficient. It could be that for Christian couples within this environment, there's a risk that contraceptive freedom paradoxically ends up being troubling rather than a relief to Christian consciences, in that children are no longer seen as gifts from God but as consumer choices in need of an explanation. This endangers the ability of Christian couples to truly welcome children. It robs us of the space to slow down and offer children the open hospitality that we ourselves have received from a gracious, loving God. In a perfect world, we would have many children, and we would greet them all with relaxed joy and not time-pressured expectations. It's a form of Christian freedom to allow God to bless us with a family if that's what he chooses to do. Now, this is not to say that thoughtful use of contraceptives to time the arrival of our children is wrong. But we do need to remember who's really in charge. I'd like to finish by leaving you with a helpful summary from English theologian Christopher Ashe. He says, "If the Creator declares procreation a blessing given to us to enable us to participate in the privilege of being his stewards in this world, we ought to value this as gift and blessing. It may be, and often is, an alarming blessing because we're not sure if we can cope with it, an inconvenient blessing impacting deeply on our lifestyles, and a costly blessing, but it is to be esteemed as a blessing, not curse. This ought to be our fundamental attitude with regard to procreation." So my prayer is that in amongst your deliberations about contraceptive use, you'll be able to find the space in your life to welcome whatever children our gracious God chooses to bless you with. Thank you. Now, according to my timing, we have about a quarter of an hour for questions. It's such a big topic, I thought it would be better if I just let you ask some questions rather than try to read your minds and work out what you wanted me to say. So, any questions? Yes?
Would sperm sites be considered maybe a chemical barrier then?
No, sperm...
The crocodile?
I'll go back to the chart so we can talk about it. So a spermicide is always used, well, a spermicide is usually used in conjunction with barrier method, but its purpose is to keep the sperm out of the uterus. So a spermicide would be considered as a way of reducing the chances of the sperm getting through to where an egg is. So it's one of those methods that separates egg and sperm. So that will be ethically okay for Christians. Yes?
What about fertility treatments? So in vitro, creating a life outside of the body and then putting it into the female body.
Okay. Big topic. I believe it is possible to use in vitro fertilisation in an ethical way. But I will say up front that if as a Christian you want to go into IVF and honour God and not park him at the door and protect the life of all your embryos, you are going to be seen as a troublemaker. And you are going to have to fight for the life of every embryo that is created on your behalf. So it's going to be tough. But I believe it is possible, and I've certainly walked through that path with a number of Christian couples. So in IVF, or in vitro fertilisation, what happens is the husband gives a sample of sperm, one egg, or if the woman has her ovulatory cycle stimulated with drugs, several eggs will be taken from the woman. And they are placed together in a dish in a laboratory to see how many embryos will form. And then, hopefully one at a time, but depending on where you go to a clinic, because IVF in the USA is the least regulated in the world. And there are some things happening here that aren't good. But generally one or two embryos will be transferred to the mother's womb in sync with her hormonal cycle, with the hope that that embryo will implant and a baby will develop and be delivered at term. Now, overall, the success rate of IVF is still probably less than 20%. And the doctor treating you wants to give you a baby, or as many babies as you want. they really want to do their job well. But when a couple presents at the door of a fertility clinic, they are usually so desperate for a child that they are emotionally vulnerable and open to any suggestion that increases the likelihood of them getting a baby. And because the doctor wants to help them, they will generally recommend that you create as many embryos as possible, because the more times you transfer an embryo to the womb, the greater the chance you'll end up with a baby. Now, there is no direct equation between the number of embryos you create and transfer and the number of live births. Some embryos won't survive being frozen and defrosted. Some will be implanted and not take. There's a higher rate of complications in pregnancy in IVF. So basically, because we don't know how many embryos you will need for X number of children, the doctors keep saying, we'll just make as many as possible. And we'll transfer one or two, we'll freeze the rest and just defrost them as you need them, and when you have as many children as you want, we'll just discard the leftovers. Now, it got to the stage where worldwide there were hundreds of thousands of frozen human embryos in storage because of this tendency that had developed to try and maximise successive results. And incidentally, that's what led to the experimentation on human embryos, where scientists saw the stockpile and thought, wow, what could we do with those? And even in my country, in Australia, where we have much stricter regulations, because of this problem of not knowing how many embryos you need for a baby, we still have this problem of accumulating embryos. So what can you do? Well, one thing you could do is say, well, I'll only have as many embryos made as I'm prepared to have children. Sometimes more than 20 embryos may be made for one couple. Not many couples around with 20 kids. So that's one place. You limit the number of eggs that you put in the dish with the sperm, so you limit the number of embryos. Most doctors would say that's foolhardy because collecting the eggs from the woman is a potentially quite dangerous procedure, and you don't want to do it more often than you have to. And so the doctors, once again, their motives are not... they're not malicious. They're actually trying to help the woman. And they think we're crazy to say we want to limit the number of embryos. But if they all take, that's how many children you'll end up with, unless you're prepared to donate those leftover embryos to someone else. So that's one of the problems. Now, once you have your embryos made in the dish, generally doctors will, or the embryologist, will look at them and judge how good they are based on their appearance. That is not a reliable way of working out which are the best ones. We do know that some of the ones that look pretty shocking can end up being babies, and some of the ones that look pretty good at that stage may fail to develop. But it's the best system we've got, so we keep using it. And what will happen in most clinics is they'll look at the embryos and just want to freeze the ones that look good and let the rest be destroyed. That's another spot at which you will have to fight for your embryos. So you'll have to let the embryologist and the doctors know you don't want any of your embryos discarded. You want them all to be frozen when it's time to store them. Now, most embryologists think that is so strange, they will ring you up to say, I was told you didn't want to have any of your embryos discarded. The people I've spoken to who've gone through this say they have to keep saying over and over again, we want to protect our embryos. But I believe that if you can go through IVF and protect your embryos and have every single one of them transferred and thus given a chance at life, you can do it in an ethical way, but it will be difficult. Now, there are some people who will think there was a lot of destruction of embryos involved in the development of IVF, and that's true. And the history of IVF is actually in my book, and the IVF chapter is extremely long because there are so many different things that they can do nowadays to add on top of the basic IVF procedure, and they have varying levels of ethical permissibility, depending on what they are. I think that it's quite a reasonable decision to say I don't want anything to do with IVF because of all the embryos that have been destroyed in the past. This is a very difficult ethical problem because a lot of the advances in modern medicine have been obtained through unethical practices. A lot of modern orthopedics is based on experiments done by the Nazis. Things we know about hypothermia, based on experiments on prisoners by the Nazis. Are we going to discard that knowledge? Should we not use? Is it unethical to use that knowledge because it was obtained in an unethical way? But we can't do the experiments again because they are unethical. So this is a very difficult situation, and so I think it is a reasonable decision to say I don't want anything to do with IVF. There is no obligation for Christian couples to do everything they can to have a child. In fact, if you did have the attitude that you would do absolutely anything possible to get a child, you are then treating childbearing as an idol, which is definitely wrong. So with the embryo issue in IVF, you need to think ahead. Any couple, I can give my little infertility talk if we've got time. I think if you find out you're infertile, infertility is a diagnosis that's made after a year of a couple having unprotected intercourse two or three times a week. If you haven't had a child in that time, technically you're infertile. And it would be reasonable for you to think about doing other things. If the woman's over 35, or if either the husband or wife has a serious medical problem, they say you should probably start to see a doctor after 6 months because you're going to have problems. But if you are infertile, it's okay to say, well, this is God's will for my life. And many couples have had greatly fulfilling lives without children. And as we've seen, God instigated marriage as an important kingdom-focused relationship without any mention of children in Genesis. You don't have to have children to have a godly marriage. So it's okay to think that this is God's plan for us. It will be hard. It will be very sad. Infertility is an incredibly, incredibly sad experience. And I think that those of us on the outside really don't understand just how difficult it is. But if you are in that situation, it's okay to do nothing. It's okay to wait. We know that only 85% of couples are going to conceive within 1 year of trying. So sometimes what's labelled infertility is in fact impatience. And if you wait 2 or 3 years, nearly 100% of those people will, I think up to about 90% will have a child. But then you have these people who continue not to have children. And I'd say, well, it's all right to just find out what the problem is. I mean, we're all curious. You might just want to go to a doctor and get a diagnosis. But I think in that case, it's important that you treat it as a joint problem, not in your problem or my problem, because that's bad for unity in the marriage. You might find out that it's something quite simple. It could be a medical problem. Maybe you've got a thyroid problem, something like that, that needs a bit of medication and that corrects the problem. There are so many different causes of infertility. When you first go to a doctor, they'll ask you lots of questions, do a very thorough examination to work out which path of investigation you need to go down because there are just so many options. And then once you find out, you can then decide whether you want to have further treatment or leave things as they are. If you find out you have a problem, some doctors will just say, we'll go straight to IVF because it's cheaper and easier than having treatment of the underlying disease. So unless you tell the doctor, if there is a treatment for underlying disease, I'm quite interested to know about it, they might not mention it to you. So if you can find an obstetrician who's a Christian, this whole process is going to be a lot easier. But otherwise, you have to keep saying, I do have some ethical issues about reproduction, and you'll need to keep saying them. Because of all these issues that make it difficult to protect the lives of your embryos once you're involved in the IVF treadmill, it's very important that before you go down the IVF track, you stop and think and collect information. Because a lot of these problems can't be dealt with in retrospect. I have couples who sit in my lounge room and tell me, I have 5 children and 10 frozen embryos, and what am I going to do? And they've come for advice a bit late. I tell them you only have to deal with one at a time, and that's what some of these couples are doing. Embryo adoption, I think, is ethical. Embryo adoption, or what's called snowflake children, all snowflakes are unique, and every embryo is unique with its own DNA. And the idea is just like, so every orphan embryo is like a snowflake. And for these orphan embryos, the only chance they have of a chance of life is if they're transferred to a woman's womb. And if a couple does find themselves in a situation where there are embryos they don't want to discard, because they tell me, look, these embryos were so precious when they were first created. We've got these children, we know this is what they look like at the start. We know these are children. We can't throw them out, but what are we going to do with them? We can't cope with more children. And in that case, an ethical choice would be to adopt out your embryos. And then it's transferred, a woman's hormonal cycle is put in sync, and she has the embryo transfer. It's like adoption at an earlier stage. You then have the pregnancy, hopefully, and the child is born. And I think that is ethical. It's what we call a redemption ethic. You might remember that Jesus told the crowd that God, even though God hated divorce because of the hardness of men's heart, he allowed it. In our broken world, there are some things that should never have happened have developed, and the stockpile of human embryos is one of them. If the only chance of life for those embryos is to be transferred to a woman's womb, I believe it's ethical to use embryo adoption to save those lives. That is not to say that you can go into IVF thinking, oh, it doesn't matter how many embryos I create because I can just adopt them out at the end if I don't want them anymore. There's a difference between a redemption ethic that tries to do the best in a bad situation and consciously doing something which will create that bad situation in the first instance. So they are your options, and sadly, you can do absolutely everything possible and may still not have a child if it's not God's choice for you.
Can I ask a follow-up question?
I think this lady comes in first, but if we've got to, what time is it? We'll have to finish off soon so people who want to leave can leave. 2 more questions, then we're finished.
I was just going to say, my only concern with the embryo adoption would be turning over someone who's had a
selective reduction is one of the unethical practices that is practiced in IVF. It is possible to find adoption agencies which are Christian. It is possible to find Christian doctors who will only transfer 1 or 2 embryos so that embryo reduction is not necessary. The only reason selective reduction occurs is because people transfer too many embryos in the first place and you've got a multiple pregnancy which is dangerous for the mother and the children, or else you have somebody who's trying to screen for abnormal embryos and kill off the abnormal ones. If you're interested in that, come back session after next and we'll be discussing it then. What last question?
Is there, if you're using oral contraceptives, the pill,
yeah,
you want to know for you personally if it prevents ovulation, can you go and have a blood test done while on the contraceptive to see what your levels are like?
It's not going to be all that helpful because we know that the first couple of months it's not going to properly suppress ovulation. And if you want to be very careful, you should use an alternative method like a barrier method the first couple of months you're on the pill if you are sexually active. There are things that reduce the effectiveness of the pill, which are things like having diarrhea, taking some drugs which stop absorption of the pill, things like that. And as I said, it's the unexpected, which causes the unplanned pregnancy, which makes the pill less effective. But the oral contraceptive pill is a highly effective contraceptive. And it's not... You can certainly find out if you're not ovulating, but I would expect most people taking the pill properly would not be ovulating. It's those times when something happens to stop absorption of the pill that you're most likely to have a problem. Thank you so much for coming. I hope you enjoy your afternoon.